I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Frederick Mounier of Jacques Frederick Mounier in Chambord on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well. I'm very happy to be here.
Very nice to have you here. So your parents met in Saigon.
Yes, especially on my mother's side, there have been travelers with an Eastern interest. My great-grandmother was Japanese. And her daughter spent most of her life in China, and she was born in China and got married in China. And my mother, I met her, my father, her husband in Saigon and, in 1954.
Interesting times to be in Saigon.
Yeah, that's the reason why they had to leave the country at short delay, just a couple of weeks after they got married. They got married just 2 weeks before the fall of Dien Bien Phu.
Your dad had studied as a lawyer, but he ended up becoming a banker.
Yeah, precisely. He was raised in Dijon, and the family owned both the vineyard and the house in Chambord. But the big business was, in fact, the company for producing liquors and aperitifs. And he decided to, after the war, he decided to leave the Dijon and to take another direction for his career. And the good decision was he decided to sell the liquor business and keep the vineyard.
So your dad had been born in the 20s, went through the war when he was still a young man, and then he leased the vineyards to Faverley starting in 1950. So like you said, right after the war, he decided to leave Burgundy.
Yes, that's exactly what he did.
And your family, as you just said, had a history of doing spirits and was particularly associated with absinthe originally as a company or earlier in the
century. Yeah, so all kind of aperitif and spirits, absinthe, cassis, and also fortified wines and or bitter aperitif with canquina, those things that were very popular at the beginning of the 20th century and much less in fashion after the war.
In the late 1800s, your family, the family that had this spirits company, had purchased vineyards in Chambord.
The domain has been a five-generation story. It's been created by my great-great-grandfather, whose name was Frederick, just like me. So he created first the spirit business and was very successful with it. And the vineyard and the house in Chambord were purchased later towards somewhere between the 1860s and early 1900s. And probably at a time when there were when it was an arguable choice to invest in the vineyards because there was so much problems in the vineyard, especially with phylloxera. Phylloxera was destroying the vineyard, and most of the purchases were done, as I understand, right after the contamination by phylloxera. So he probably has been able to buy the vineyard for a low price. In fact, the oldest bottle of wine I have drank with the family bottle was a Mussigny 1915. It was very good. That was in that was maybe 10 years ago, and the wine was surprisingly in a surprisingly good condition. Most of the times, people tend to think that Bordeaux can age longer and better than Burgundy, and well, I'm really not sure it's the case. I have some wines from the 30s in my cellar, which are fresh like babies, incredibly young and fresh. Obviously, it's not every vintage and it's not every wine, but the best ones can age clearly 100 years and more.
You make white wine from Chardonnay now that's planted at the northern part of Clos de Marechal and Louis-Saint-George, but for a long time, like 50 years, that wine wasn't made. And it was made because you found some old bottles of white?
Yes, probably the bottling of the wines was not done in Chambord, but in Dijon, where they have had all the facilities for the spirits. And I suspect that their stocks of bottled wines was held in Dijon. And it's only when they sold the business in Dijon that they decided to bring back some of their stocks to Chambord in what is now my cellar. So I don't have the whole range of all the wines, all the vintages, but they brought only the best ones, the ones they wanted to drink, and I mean sometimes in some good quantities. So I had only one Clos de la Maréchal Blanc in the cellar, which was 1943. Well, in fact, I had a bottle last week, just last Sunday, with a visiting friend. Not as exciting as it was 10 years ago, I must say. But after 70 years in my cellar, it was still excellent and very good, fresh and expressive. It's clearly a vineyard that produces wines that can age.
So the family purchases Clos de Marechal, which is in Louis-Saint-George, actually in Premo in 1902.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit later than a Chambord property. And it's a sizable monopole.
Yes, it's a large vineyard, at least by Burgundy standards. It's almost 10 hectares. That must be 25 acres. And it's the largest monopole, at least as a premier cru, in Burgundy. It's a really good thing to be in charge of, to be in control of a large piece of vineyard. We are used in Burgundy to work very tiny pieces here and there, a few rows between neighbors on both sides. A large vineyard is in fact not more difficult but easier to work, and it gives more consistent quality year after year because different sections will react differently to the weather every year, and the quality is more consistent.
So your dad went off in a career that took him to different parts of the world. He left Dijon and he leased the vineyards both in Chambord and in Louis-Saint-George to Faverly with long-term lease starting in 1950. And then towards the end of his life, he gets the vineyards back because he dies in 1980, but he gets the vineyards back in 77.
Yes, in 1977, was the year of the end of one of the contract, and the contract had to be renegotiated. And it was difficult because the law in France protects the farmer against the owner, and the owner is not in a position to impose its conditions. So it really had to be a negotiation, and Guy Fevelet at the time was also a doctor in law, as my father. Actually, they were friends from the university.
So that would be Erwan's grandfather, actually.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Guy's son was François, and Erwan is François's son. So the negotiation was that to get rid of the legal limitations regarding the renewal of the contract, a part of the domain, which was a piece of Clos Vougeot, half an hectare of Clos Vougeot, in fact, would become a Fevelis property. And Claude Lamarchal, yeah, the lease would be renewed for a 25-year period. On the other hand, my father was free on the Chambol-Musigny part of the vineyard. And that was a smart arrangement, because the Chambol side is, in fact, the most precious. It includes the Musigny, Bonnemar, Amoureuse. It's small enough to be manageable and not involve too big investment. And yeah, it was the right approach to get back in the business of making wine.
What your dad did is he hired a registrar to make the wine, and then that wine was often sold to Negos after it was made.
My father still had a job in Paris, and a young girl. In 1977, my sister was 10 years old at school in Paris. My father still had his job in Paris, and he couldn't move to Chambol and to control the domain. So he had to rely on one of his school friends, who was Bernard Clair. Bernard Clair is Bruno Clair's father. And so he was appointed as a manager for the domain at the time.
So he would vinify and then often sell to Jadot.
Yeah, the wine was vinified in Chambol under the control of Bernard Clair and sold in bulk to Négociant. Making wine again in Chambol was implying big investments. We had no equipment, and it takes a very long time before you pay for the work and the expenses in the vineyard, and the time when you are able to have something to sell. You have to keep the business working and the work made for 3 years as a minimum before you get the first cent back from the from selling the wines. It means a lot of money, and my father was living on his salary in a bank, and we just could not invest too quickly in the business. So selling to Négociant was the solution, was the easy solution, the only one, actually.
If I were to find a Jadot, Chambol, Amoureuse from the 1980 vintage or 81 vintage, that might be Meunier fruit.
Yeah, most likely the largest part of the wine is from our vineyards, yes.
So your father passes away in 1980, and at the time you were in the Middle East?
Yes, I studied engineering at university, and I finished in 1979. And I spent 5 years on offshore oil projects as a design or construction engineer. And oil is found mostly in non-wine drinking countries, I must say. My first job was in Norway, where at the time nobody was drinking wine. All alcoholic beverages were very highly taxed, and it was people were preparing their own beverage from powder wine and the medical alcohol. And then I moved to the Gulf States and Saudi Arabia.
Eventually, you decided to make a change because you took a sabbatical from that work.
Yeah, at some point, I realized that my family had a very precious property in Burgundy. And we were not taking all the care that was necessary, that was needed in with this vineyard. Didn't know much. I didn't know anything about wine. When I had participated in a couple of harvests, but for a short period, for a few days during my holidays in between 1980 and 1984. But that was all. I didn't know anything about wine and winemaking, and I had very little experience of wine drinking, except the wines we could have at the family table and on Sundays when I was a kid. So I clearly needed to get there and spend some time to look around and try to understand the way things go in Burgundy and what it is to make wine. So I asked for a sabbatical leave from my company, and I spent a year in Chambord. And after a year, clearly, it was clear I wouldn't get back to engineering.
What do you think was the moment of realization, or maybe the cause of the realization, that you decided that this was a special thing to get back to? What brought on that decision-making?
It's a very special job. It's a very rare position to have such a total control on what you're doing. I can plant a vineyard, work it, harvest it, make the wine, bottle it, sell it, meet the people who drink it. I control everything from the field to the customer. There are very few jobs where you can have such a total control in a production process, in fact, in the modern world. That's very rewarding. If you succeed, if the consumer is satisfied with the wine, if he gets pleasure from it, you can take the responsibility of it. If you fail, it's your responsibility too. You cannot blame anybody else. But I like it.
So did it appeal to a part of your training as an engineer when you came back to look at something a little differently? Did you feel that the two lives intersected in some way when you came back?
Yeah, I wanted to use as much of from technique and science as I could, but I did not take very much time before I realized that it just doesn't work. Wine is not like oil or steel. In fact, the big difference is the quality of wine cannot be defined in just a couple of parameters. And inequality cannot even be defined on a linear scale. This wine is slightly better than this wine, but not as good as another one. Basically, quality in wine is an aesthetical question. There is no absolute truth. It's subjective. Anybody who has an opinion, who tastes the wine and really pays attention and is open to what he feels from this wine, when he has an opinion on the wine, he cannot be wrong. If he finds it good, it's good. Somebody else can have a different opinion, but there is no referee that can decide what is good and what is better and not as good. It just doesn't mean anything. We do our best to make the best possible wines, but best is not enough. What is really important is that each wine must have a personality of its own. Each wine must be distinct from any other one.
It sounds like what you're saying is that the part that you liked was the opposite of the engineering part. The part that you liked was kind of embracing a different part of your brain.
What I liked in wine, you can say it that way, is exactly the opposite of what can be found in industry.
So you get back and you speak with Bernard Clair, who, as you said, is Bruno Clair's father and who made the 84s, although you were there for harvest. And what did he tell you about the program for the vineyards and the wines?
Yeah, you know, did not give me great directions for what I should do or not do. Yeah, he was very pragmatic, and well, this is what I do. I show you what I know, the way I make wine. I've been making wine for so many years. He was very experienced. But yeah, I had to find my own way later.
And how did that come about? So the first bottlings of Meunier are 84. You're there from 85. And then what happens?
Well, there was a worker in, we call that kind of contract, à la tâche or tâcheron. He don't come to get his instruction every morning to decide on, but he's responsible. He's in charge of a list of works that have to be done in the vineyard at the right time. But I had no direct control, every day on his works. But he was a very, very serious man and a good worker, and he's somebody I could very strongly rely on. And that way, he was very precious to me.
Does he still work with you?
He retired in 2003, and he passed away a couple of years ago now. So then came the my first harvest, 1985, and I was very fortunate. It was an excellent harvest with a very good quality grapes. And I've done what I've seen Bernard Clair do, and his name is Bernard Audifred, the vineyard worker who has been in charge for a long time of the vineyard. And well, we've done what they were used to do, and I thought it was very simple. Well, you harvest the grapes, you bring them into the fermenting vats, and you wait until the fermentation starts, and when the fermentation is over, you empty the tank and press the skins and transfer the wine into the barrels, and that's it. And that's almost as simple as that. It was almost as simple as that. And when looking backward, it's almost frustrating to see how easy it was and how good the wines were. And it's something that I keep in mind all the time. It does not take a great winemaker to make a great wine. Making wine is a very simple process. It's very natural. When the grapes are of good quality, it can be just as simple as that.
But it helps when you have Mousigny and Amarouse and Bonnemare.
Of course. The great vineyards, the Grand Cru vineyards, are the easiest to work. There are those who, well, I was going to say those who never freeze. But 2016 proved the contrary. But still, those who rarely freeze, those who are less affected by disease, mildew and rot. In fact, rework is always easier in Grand Cru vineyards. Yeah, it's something I keep in mind, the fact that the greatest wine can be made with very little action from the winemaker. The process can be kept very simple and natural. What is more difficult is not to make one great wine once in a decade or once in a life. What is difficult is to make good wine every year, and whatever the quality of the grapes, whatever the weather. So that's why, in fact, I'm much prouder of difficult vintages where I think I've been able to make some good wines than the greatest wines that were made, which may have been made just by chance.
As you started to learn the crus, because you have, as we just said, Mousigny, Bonnemare, Les Amarouses, you have Le Fouy, now you have Maréchal back in Neuilly-Saint-Georges, and then you have a couple other parcels that go into your Chambeau Village. So when you look at the crus and you look back on those 85s, and as you started to walk the vineyards more, what did you find?
I'm not sure I have I'm the one who is in the best position to have an opinion on my own wines, in fact. It seems to me my style must have changed. I'm doing things very differently now than I was at the time. But I'm surprised sometimes when some people tell me that my 1985 or 86 or 88 are clearly in my style, which I think must have changed. In fact, what I mean is I cannot really relate the style of the wines I've made with the way they have been made, with the details of the process that have produced those wines. I've changed from whole clusters to destemming, from hot maceration to cooler ones, shorter to longer, and many things have changed. And still, it seems that there is a common style that has resisted all these changes. I'm not a mystic man, and I have no interest in the esoteric things and all this, but I've come to the point when it seems to me that there is something spiritual that goes through into the wine, that dictates the style of the wines. Whatever, independently from the actual treatments that have been applied to the wines.
It seems like that, from my limited experience, holds the most true for the Musigny and the Amaroux in terms of your lineup, in terms of what seems like the same character all the way through, even if the technique has changed a little bit.
Yeah, well, Musigny and Amaroux must have a stronger personality than the others, and a character that resists the winemaker, in fact.
I mean, I don't know if you agree, but to me, it seems like this. Like, even we were discussing how, because Amunier parcels were sold to Drouhin at an earlier point, that you're often a neighbor of Drouhin. And for me, when I think about Drouhin Musigny from like 88, the quality of that wine texturally and the kind of fruit, I can see a family resemblance to the Meunier Musigny, even though, you know, I'd asked you in the context of, did you think it was the same vine material? And you said no. So, you know, maybe it's just aspect on the slope. But for me, there did seem to be a resemblance.
Well, actually, in 1988, probably the vine material was the same in Musigny and, well, in part of Musigny and Amaroux on both sides, Meunier or Drouhin. Both vines had been planted in the early 20th century, the first half of the 20th century. And it was the same vine, so it may be, or it's certainly a reason why there is a common style in the two. But it seems to me it's still the case now, and many of the vineyards have been replanted since.
So the Faverley team did some replants of certain vineyards.
Yeah, Faverley was in charge of the replanting in all of our vineyards. In fact, we had no control on the replanting of the vines.
04 came along, or I should say late 03 came along, and you got Marischal back, which was in Louis St. George. And that's, as you said, a larger parcel, one of the biggest monopoles around. And so that meant you really had to scale up as a producer, because what you'd said before is you had a small holding and you were able to do it with a small facility and a small staff. But bringing in that amount of hectare meant that you had to make some infrastructure changes about 20 years after you started.
Yeah, the size of the domain has been multiplied by 3.5 in a day, in fact. And so it implied big changes. I needed more space. I had to build a new fermenting room and a new cellar. Yeah, I had to hire a full new team in 2004. My vineyard worker was working only part-time for me and sometimes with the help of his wife. So it was a little more than one full-time worker. I've hired seven workers for the vineyard. So given that the surface of the vineyard was multiplied by 3.5, I almost doubled the number of man hours spent on each vine every year. It was a clear decision I made. I wanted to improve the quality of the work in the vineyard. And also the type of contract was different. I had now the full control on the staff in the vineyard. And we've changed many things at the time. We've changed the pruning system. In fact, we used two systems. You know, on our old vines, old meaning more than 30 years, something like that, we have modified the Guyot pruning system for a long cane pruning system, which gives a better exposure of the leaves to the sunshine. And the younger vines are pruned with the Cordon de Roya system.
So that's true both in Chambol and in Maréchal. It's a younger, older thing. It's not a terroir thing.
The work in the vineyard is the same in all the vineyards. The team is the same. We were doing much more debudding, and we were taking a lot of efforts to have a very tidy, very neat trellis with the vineyard.
So you do a long cane and on the old vines, and then you actually do debudding. So you take a bud off so it's not that many.
Yes, the idea is to have more space between the shoots. The wind can flow more easily between the leaves and the clusters, and it prevents the accumulation of moisture around the grapes and therefore disease. And it's a period when we had to do green harvests in most of years. So that was pretty much more work, but it shows in the wines. It seems to me there's a clear, Claude Le Maréchal was new, but the same methods were used in Chambol as well. And you can see the difference in the quality of the wines around 2004.
So the gentleman who had been looking after the vineyards for you, he retires. At the same time, you get a lot more vineyard acres. And so you hire a new team. And you mentioned that you were green harvesting a lot, but I think now what you prefer to do is do what you alluded to, which is more debudding instead of green harvesting. So when you first got the vineyards back, you had to do a lot of green harvesting, but now you try not to.
Well, green harvest is not something satisfactory for it's something I hate to do. It's totally, completely unnatural. It's when we have to do it, sometimes we really have, because we know that if the crop is too big, the grapes will not ripen properly. So we have to remove the grapes that are in excess. But clearly it's the sign of something unbalanced in the vineyard. It's either too vigorous vines or the soil that is too rich or something else. So, in a way, I was happy to see that after 2009, we had naturally lower, smaller crops. The problem now is the trend is still directed downwards.
You get less quantity every year.
We have less quantity every year. So green harvest, I would be happy next year if I have to do a green harvest, I must say. No, it seems that the balance in the vineyard has moved from an excessive vigor to not enough vigor. And we have the problem is everything we do in the vineyard, every change we do in the vineyard, in the way we fertilize the soil or the way we do the work on the vines takes a very long time before it brings its effects. And in a way, we have starved our vines in the 2000s, at the beginning of the century. And we only see now the effect of bringing not enough fertilizers to the vines.
Because you had stopped fertilizing and you had stopped with herbicides and pesticides earlier in the 90s.
Yes, I've stopped herbicides very early. It was just a few years after I started to make wine in Burgundy. That's something that I found unnatural and I didn't like. And my philosophy is if it's not absolutely necessary, it shouldn't be done. And it applies to herbicides as well as anything else. Any operation that is not strictly necessary should be avoided. I would like to have an expression of my vines that would be as natural as possible. There's something that about that that works very well with in the cellar, with the work on the wines. The less, the better. But it seems it doesn't work quite well in the vineyard. Producing good grapes take an awful lot of work. You cannot say, I'll let my vines grow the way they feel good, and they will, if they feel good, I will get good grapes. It's something, it seems that the project of the vines is not to produce the kind of grapes we are looking for. So really, we have to stress them. We have to prune them severely, and it takes a lot of work.
So you get Marischal back for 04, and you developed a second bottling out of Marischal under the old name of the property that was a Valage bottling. And that bottling is where some of the more high-yielding vines of Marischal went and where some of the young vines of Marischal went. So I think right away you realized that you weren't immediately getting the kind of grapes that you wanted because you came up with this other bottling.
Yeah, in 2004, with the first vintage of Claude Le Maréchal, it was a big challenge. And I really wanted to get the best possible wine from this vineyard and to offer to the public only the best possible wine. And I decided to make a selection. By nature, it's a big vineyard. All the grapes would not fit in one tank, and necessarily there are several cuvées of this vineyard. And before bottling, I made a selection. I used only the best cuvées to make the Claude Le Maréchal. And the other ones were bottled under the name Claude Fourche. I decided to, I needed to have a name, and I decided to use the old name, the historic name of Claude Le Maréchal. The name Claude Le Maréchal appears only towards the end of the 19th century. Until then, it was known as Claude Fourche, and I have used that name. I say only the best were grapes in Claude Le Maréchal and the not so good ones in Claude Fourche. It doesn't work exactly that way. So I arranged the blends from the initial, I think it was 9 cuvées. I arranged the blends to have 2 different styles, then 2 different levels of quality. I wanted to make a Claude Le Maréchal that would be serious, structured, long-lived, with an intensity, with a good intensity. And Claude Fourche had to be more like a pretty wine, attractive, fresh, and easier, a wine that could be drunk earlier than Claude Le Maréchal.
I don't see it so much in New York, the Claude Le Fourche.
No, actually, there are only a few vintages where I produced Claude Le Fourche. There was 2004, 2006, 7, and 8. And so 8 is the last vintage where I've produced Claude Le Fourche. All the grapes have gone into the Claude Le Maréchal bottling since 2008. Seems to me I now get more even quality throughout the vineyard. One reason can just be that the young vines are 10 years older, and so they are not so young, and it doesn't make such a difference between the young vines and the others. But it's certainly not the only reason. Well, I think we've come to know better the vineyard, every spot in the vineyard, and to adapt the work to the specificities of each spot. And we now get a much better quality, and I find that the best cuvée is always the blend of all of them.
And why do you think that there's numerous monopoles of Nuit Saint-Georges in Premo, like that sector of Nuit Saint-Georges? Why are there multiple monopoles? Something historically, or?
That's very curious, I must say. It's clearly, Premo must have a different history, but in fact, it dates back to the beginning of the 19th century. And some of the monopoles there have been created by one man who managed to purchase small plots here and there and unite them in one big block. And but Claude Lamarchal is older than most of the others. Claude Lamarchal was already a monopole in the 1820s. It appears on the first map of the Burgundy Vineyard, which is Cadastre Napoléon, from 1827. And it shows Claude Lemarchal exactly as it is now, with the same walls and the same house in the middle. But my neighbor, Claude Larlot, was constituted much later, in around the 1860s or 70s.
How do you think of Premo as a part of Nuit Saint-Georges yourself?
Yes, Premo is a special sector within Nuit Saint-Georges. Nuit Saint-Georges is a quite extended appellation. It extends from Vaughan-Romanée on the north side to Claude Lamarchal. Claude Lamarchal is the last vineyard to the south. And the Premo sector, the south sector, is clearly different. We have arranged with our neighbors in Premo tasting of Premo wines, Premo monopole vineyards a couple of times. And it was very interesting with me because it shows a very different expression of Nuit Saint-Georges. Also in the 19th century books, especially Laval in 1855, the wines from Premo are described as the finest in Nuit Saint-Georges. And it was a time when what was precious in wine was finesse was more precious than concentration. Quality was really identified with finesse, and Premo wines were the most precious in the sector. Laval says that the wines from Premo were selling for the same price as the Clos Vougeot.
You indicated that you felt that these days the Maréchal is best as a blend of the different parts of Maréchal, which is a fairly large, as you said, monopole. So take me through that a little bit. What are the different parts? Obviously, the north part is planted to Chardonnay. What's the reasoning there in terms of why that part?
Yes, the Chardonnay has been planted as a strip along the north side wall. And I had three reasons to choose this section. One was it's the part of the vineyard that is closest to Clos de Larlot, and especially the white vines from Clos de Larlot. And Clos de Larlot Blanc is an absolutely delicious wine, which I really like very much. So the idea was, if it's good on the other side of the wall, it shouldn't be too bad on my side. The other reason was maybe more serious. Maybe it's just the same. In fact, the soil is slightly different from the soil in other parts of the Claude Lamarchal. It's lighter, sandier, and whiter. In fact, it looks like, by its aspect, it seems more suited to Chardonnay than other sections. But in fact, there was a third reason, which is it was planted with a very poor selection of Pinot Noir. And grafting Chardonnay on these vines was a way to get rid of these poor clones.
So what about the other sectors for red? Do you find it varies?
No, well, the soil and the subsoil is relatively consistent throughout the vineyard of Claude Lamarchal. It's something that surprised me when I've come to know the vineyard better. But when you look at the situation, where you think it's very different from Chambord. Where the slope is steeper and there are more movement in the terrain. And Claude Lamarchal is rather flat and with very little slope. You could think it's deep soil and probably very clay. In fact, clay is only very superficial. The solid bedrock is close to the surface, only 50, 60 centimeters under the surface. Very close to what we have in most of Chambolle-Mézénine. So it's basically solid limestone with clay on the top. And the type of limestone is very interesting because it's what is called oolitic limestone. It's kind of soft and porous limestone. That type of stone can retain water during period of drought.
Which is unusual for limestone. Usually the opposite happens.
The upper layer is what is called calcaire de Comblanchien. It's used to make floor tiles. It's very, very dense. And it's just not porous at all. It can resist to frost if it's used outside. And it's stone that it's a type of stone that is well appreciated for any type of construction. Oolitic is soft and retains water. Water is the most important factor for the quality of the grapes. In fact, the signature of a great terroir is a terroir that can both drain away any excess of water after heavy rains, but also retain enough water during long period of droughts to feed the vines. And that kind of subsoil is very interesting from this point of view. So let's say that kind of profile is about three-quarter or seven-eighths of Claude La Maréchale. There's only a small part on the southeast corner where we have deep soil, which can be either a clay in some parts or sand and stones in others. And that's certainly the location of the ancient stream that used to flow there.
I didn't know that. And when you have the wines, do you find a kind of a straightforward aging curve, like in a linear fashion, or does it go through curves at different periods of its time in terms of open, close?
We've done some progress in the way the wines age. They now age in a more consistent way, more progressively, more linearly. The wines have a more predictable evolution. They don't go through steep ups and downs during their first years of aging. We get riper grapes, we handle them with more care, and we do a softer winemaking. That's probably the reason. We don't extract rough tannins as much as we used to 20, 30 years ago.
How did you come to that idea? Because I feel like a certain kind of winemaking was very popular in Burgundy in the mid-80s when you come back. But you are not of that milieu. And then you came back and you developed your own palate. And of course, you had your own vineyard sources. And you know, you're reflecting off that taste. But you essentially go in a whole other direction that wasn't popular in the 80s, and you develop an idea that I think now a lot of people look at as kind of an ideal for what, you know, especially Chambolle is supposed to taste like, but like what Burgundy is supposed to taste like. But what were some of the influences along the way? Because you're an interesting case study as a guy who isn't in the Burgundy world and then comes back with key holdings in Burgundy and develops a palate for them. What was happening?
Well, I do what I can do. I've tried to make wine. I've tried to learn how to make wine and do my best every year and improve my wines every year. In the 1990s, the great word to express the quality of a wine in Burgundy, but it's not specific to Burgundy. The great word was concentration. And everybody was looking for, was trying to make deeper wines, more with a dark color and lots of structure. And that was certainly a reaction against lean, diluted wines that were sometimes produced in the 1980s and 1970s. And we certainly needed some movement in some changes in that direction. Well, I've tried to some extent, and maybe I just didn't succeed. I didn't try too much, I must say.
To make big wines.
To make big wines. To make big wines.
Because you used to punch down more when you first started, you told me.
Yes. Yes. In the first years I've done, I was doing a lot of punching downs. I was fermenting at high temperatures. I progressively softened my winemaking. But in the 1990s, my wines were considered as light, rather pale, and it was certainly not the most fashionable style. But I must say, I was feeling comfortable with my winemaking. I could accept the fact that my wines didn't have all the possible qualities, but they had enough of some, and to make them interesting. I'm not sure I'm a leader, but I'm certainly not a follower. I like to go my own way and do my own experiments. I've learned to make wine mostly by trial and error. I've done my own experiments. In my early years, I could change completely from one excess to the opposite excess the following year. From cold fermentation to very hot maceration, from whole clusters to whole destemming, and everything. I've tried in all directions. And I know, and when I taste the wines now, in fact, I'm amazed at the fact that it does not really change so much the style of the wines. Probably the terroir and the vines are stronger than the winemakers than the winemaker.
And one of the things that's interesting about that terroir, the set that you have, at least for me, is that you have Bonmar and the vineyard next to Bonmar, and you have Musigny and the vineyard next to Musigny. It's an interesting set. It's the big brother and the little brother in both cases, almost.
Yeah, Les Fouets and Bonmar are appellations, but my plots are not exactly neighbors. They are probably 300 meters away, which in Burgundy is a long distance. Amouroz and Musigny are closer neighbors. And I used to see them as the big brother and the little child, or the mother and the daughter. In fact, I've realized that it's much more complicated than that, and it's very strange. The location is almost the same. The soil is not very different. It's basically the same profile with some differences, but. The differences between the two vineyards are sometimes smaller than the differences that can be observed in within the same vineyard. So it's difficult to explain the difference in the wine only by the differences in the soil, in what we know of the soil. So the wines should be very, very similar, and I find that they are very different. The flavors can be quite similar. The palate is more or less common, but the structure of the wines is very different. Musigny is very intense, very deep, and it's very seamless. Musigny has a seamless texture. It's Amoureuse in a way just the opposite. It's always vibrant. It comes as a succession of different impressions.
That makes sense. I mean, I almost feel like that's a Grand Cru character, to be fully one thing. although nuanced. Does that make sense? Like, I think of that way about, like, Chambertin. I think that way about Latoche. Like, I'm not talking about the parcel being different. There's differences in Latoche, but I just mean when it hits your palate, it seems like a unified thing.
Yeah, Mezzine is perfectly, it's completely unified. It's perfectly integrated. It's which makes it very impressive and certainly gives a hint of what its potential for aging and its greatness, its potential future greatness. Amoureuse is just the opposite. It's completely expressive, completely open. It gives immediately a succession of very different sensations. It's vibrant. It shines more than Musigny, but it doesn't have the same tight and integrated texture. Musigny is greater. It doesn't mean that Les Amoureuses is not as great. There's something about the idea of greatness that is a little bit confusing, but Amoureuse has something that Musigny doesn't have. Amoureuse, there's an emotion in Amoureuse that is related to a kind of fragility that you can find in the wine. The flavors you receive are very subtle and come one after the other. And at the time when you can pick it, identify it, it's gone. Musigny is just the opposite. It's here, it's stable. That's two different expressions. But when you taste both of the wines as young wines, the emotion is definitely on the Amoureuse side.
It's interesting because when you go to the tasting at the cellar, those two are usually served next to each other, whereas the Bon Mar precedes the Amoureuse in the usual order, which is not how most people would do it, I think. Most people would put the Grand Crus together.
Yes, the usual order for tasting is Village, Premier Cru, Grand Cru, and more or less the wines are arranged in terms of prices. But I prefer to have a kind of geographical order, it makes it easier to perceive the terroirs, the logic of the terroirs. We usually taste Les Fuets, Bon Mar, Amoureuse, Musigny in that order, which is a north to south order. And the neighbors are tasted side by side, Bon Mar with Les Fuets, Amoureuse with Musigny. And the similarities and the differences can be more easily perceived, I think.
And it seems also to be a vine age thing. The Bon Mar is not as old as the Musigny vines.
Yes, certainly. The Bon Mar, when I took over the vineyard in 1985, I quickly realized I wasn't very satisfied with the quality of the vines that had been planted there in Bon Mar. So I decided to pull up a large section of the vineyard, something like half of the vineyard. So the Bon Mar has been made from young vines, mostly from young vines in the 1990s and 2000s. And it's only now that old vines in Bon Mar are more than 30 years, and it makes a big difference. And I've seen the quality and the density, the texture of the wine improving in recent years very clearly.
Because with the Musigny, you take the young vine Musigny and you put it in the Chambeau Village.
I've done very little replanting in my vineyard as a general rule, and in Musigny specifically. There's only a small section that was replanted in 1997, and the young vines are declassified to Chambeau.
And with the Bon Mar, you have both soil types. You know, sometimes people talk about the Terre Blanche and Terre Rouge of Bon Mar, the white and the red, but you have both.
Yes, the top part of the plot is the Terre Blanche, the lower part is Terre Rouge. Bon Mar is my smallest vineyard. I make only three or four barrels every year. So it's too small to ferment the two types separately. And anyway, it wouldn't mean much because the age of the vines would be different and the vine selection would be different.
One of the things I found fascinating when I visited your cellar, which wasn't that long ago, so I feel like it's closer to the mature winemaking style as opposed to what you were describing before, where you modified the technique frequently. What I found is that there's a uniform consistency on how you approach the wine year to year.
Yes. That's a very interesting point. The first thing that is very important to keep in mind is my wines are all made exactly the same way. There's strictly no difference in the process. In the winemaking of Chambol, Musigny, Village, and the Grand Cru, or Nuit Saint-Georges. They're all made exactly the same way.
Which is unusual in Burgundy. Most people wouldn't do it that way.
Yeah, it's always tempting for a winemaker to show his skills and try to adapt his winemaking to the particular, to the specificities of any vineyard. And one can think that this plot produces grapes with less tannins than others, and therefore there must be more extraction to balance the wine, and less is needed in the other one. But I think it's a mistake. It's more interesting to let each terroir speak without interfering. There's less chance, there's less risk that you, the winemaker, will ruin the natural balance of the grapes. That was one of the first questions I've been answering. Asking myself when I started to make wine: should I extract more in ripe vintage or not so ripe vintage? There are good reasons in both directions. In a ripe vintage, the quality of the tannins is supposed to be good, so it's possible to extract more. But on the other way, there's less need to extract more because there is naturally more tannins in the grapes. And it took me a long time before I could make up my mind on this question. I finally decided to give no answer to the question and make the wine the same way in each type of vintage. It seems to me the more you try to interfere, the more risk you take of ruining the natural balance of the grapes. Well, there was one vintage that taught me a lot on this question, which was 2003. 2003 was the year of the canicule, as we say in French. It was a extremely hot weather. The date of harvest was the earliest ever. The grapes suffered from the heat. Some dried on the vines. Sugar was high. The acidity was low. There was every possible reason to think you had to make the wine in a totally different way from what you do usually. And technicians, oenologists were pushing strongly to change your ways of making wine. And many growers have changed completely what they were doing. They picked much earlier. They made short fermentations, they acidified the wines. And I find that these wines are now unbalanced. And the ones that had enough serenity to wait for more reasonable date of harvest, wait until the weather cooled down and some rain could fall. Those who fermented the grapes just as they normally do, with the normal duration of fermentation and a normal extraction, and no addition of anything, well, actually they made the best wines, the most balanced wines. This is, I think, very clear and very, very typical. So if it works in 2003, it should work in any other vintage. And from then on, I've decided I would make the wine almost the same way every year, with just a very careful, very prudent evolution from one year to another one, because it's normal to try to improve from one year to another one. But it's more like a slow trend than any revolution. I've become very careful in the changes I make now in my winemaking.
That, to me, is an amazing kind of study in terroir, which is what Burgundy's all about, right? Setting it up that way really allows you to say, okay, well, that's the taste of Musigny and that's the taste of Bonmar, because they're made the same way. And then comparing 6 to 7, for example, it's the same thing. It's the same winemaking, so you should be able to see the vintage. The part that seems to vary for me when I taste through the young wines is the way that the fruit carries itself in the first few vintages from release, not texturally, not the flavor, but how juicy or how much lift there is to the fruit will vary to the vintage, I find, with a Meunier wine. Because I think you're using the same technique and then the vintage kind of shows what it has. This is my impression.
Yeah, well, I suppose there is a Meunier style that shows vintage after vintage, whatever the weather, and it's visible through the mark of each vintage. But the most important is what I'm interested in my wines is, I like to say, well, it's what I cannot control. What is really interesting in my wines is what I cannot control. It's what comes from the terroir, from the place where the grapes are grown, and from the climate as well, from the weather as well. It's the expression of nature, and the expression of nature will always be more complex, richer, better balanced, more harmonious than what comes from the technology I've used to make the wine.
And I think that gets back to that original point that you made about it not being the engineering part that's interesting to you about the wines.
Yes. Wine is the contrary of an engineered product. It's not. I'm the contrary of a perfume maker. A perfume maker has a project. He wants to make a perfume with certain style, probably to suit a certain market. And he's trying to find a recipe to make that perfume. I have no project for my wines. I don't want them to taste like something else. I see them as living beings with a personality of their own. Making wine to me is more like raising children, or a better comparison would be a winemaker is more a gardener than anything else. A gardener does not design the flowers. He just takes care of the seeds to let them grow and protect them against what could prevent them from developing into the most beautiful flower. But he cannot decide on the shape and the color of the flowers. And I'm happy with that vision of my job, my responsibility in the job I make. Well, I suppose it's a point of view that you can accept only after you've done your own experience. While young winemakers have to show all their talent and experiment in all possible different ways, but then you come to a point where you have to make decisions. What do you really want to do, and what kind of wine do you really want to make? And then you have to decide not to do things you could do. And it can be a great satisfaction.
Well, it's a winemaking of subtraction, in a way. You're subtracting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a relation with Asian philosophy here. My purpose is to go to the core, to find the essence of a vineyard, which is indeed a subtractive process. What does really makes the most important part of the personality of this wine? What do I choose to let appear in this wine? And what should not be part of the final wine? Rough tannins, of course, should not be. The most delicate nuances of the fruit must be. It's a selection. That's why it's I don't try to extract too much of my grapes. The process has to be very soft to extract only the most delicate components of the grapes.
And you don't like to rack?
I don't do too many rackings. I usually do two, one after 1 year, 1 year in the barrels, and the second one 6 months later at the time of bottling.
And a light toast on the French wood?
Light toast. I don't use much new oak. New oak should not be noticeable in the wines. I have no interest for the taste of oak. It can be attractive, but it's not what I want to show. I'm fortunate to be in charge of some of the most precious vineyards in the world. What I want to express in my wines is what is there in the vineyard, not what I can buy from what anybody can buy from the tonnelier, from the coopers.
Frédéric Mounier went searching for oil and found wines that were precious but that he could not control. Thank you very much for being here today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Frédéric Mounier of Jacques Frédéric Mounier in Chambolle in Burgundy.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Skella has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's ILLDrinktothatPOD.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening. While I was doing background research for this interview, I used the resources burgundyreport.com and winehog.org. That's burgundy-report.com and winehog, no space, .org. Both of those are great Burgundy references, and if you're interested in learning more about Mounier, as I was when I was thinking about questions for this interview, they're great places to look.